The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'm going to take you on a journey into a particular, the world of a particular discourse of the Buddha, maybe into a little bit into the world of ancient India. And it's a discourse which has a very famous teaching, which gets quoted many times in the West, often out of context, just kind of pulled out and just taught by itself. And that's the simile of the raft. Probably some of you have heard this. And the most common way the simile of the raft is presented is that with a story that kind of comes along with it. And this kind of story or the narrative is that if a person comes to a river and needs to cross the river, this is in ancient India where there were no, you know, maybe bridges in the same way we have them today. And so how do you get across the river? Well, you have to have a raft. So you build a raft and use the raft to get across. And then if you get across the river and you then pull the raft out of the water and put it on your back and start walking in through the forest to continue on your travels, is that wise? And general answer is no, it's not so wise, because unless there's a river just a few yards beyond, again, because there is, it's cumbersome to carry a big raft and make your way through the forest, probably a narrow path. What you do is you use the raft to get across the river, and then you leave the raft behind. And in the same way, the Buddha said, the same way, this is how we relate to Buddhism. Buddhism itself, it can be seen as a raft, and so it has a pragmatic function, but Buddhism is meant to self-destruct once you get across the river. You know, and you don't take it with you, you don't carry it with you, you don't burden your neighbors with it. By holding on to it, you just leave it behind. Once it's done its job. And so it's a nice teaching, especially for people who like to be kind of not too attached to their religion and don't feel like they're kind of a little bit religion leery. And so to see, well, it's kind of provisional, all this Buddhism. I don't have to really kind of, adopt this creed. I just have to adopt it enough to get me across the river to freedom from suffering. That's usually, I think that's probably fair enough, one of the ways, common ways in which it's presented here in the West. Some of you have heard it, right? This teaching's about the raft. So the discourse I'm going to present it about is the discourse where this teaching appears. And it's a little bit of a follow-up from last week's talk, where I got feedback from a few people that they didn't understand it. This one can be just as have the same fate, that you won't understand it. But to take that into account, what I'll try to do is to let the talk develop slowly, and hopefully the beginning part will be the most understandable. And then, as you go along, if you're able to follow, great. If not, then you got something at the beginning before you tuned out. So the way the simile is concluded, the conclusion, the teaching the Buddha wants to get across, this is just as the Dharma that he teaches is like a raft. So you should let go of dharmas. Here, dharmas can be understood as teachings. You should let go of teachings, and even more so, wrong teachings. The wrong teaching here is in Pali's adhamma. So whatever teachings you have, you should let go of at some point. So what is it? So why is emphasis on letting go of teaching once it's done its job? Is it because, because the Buddha wasn't so much into religion, and so you should not, get too caught up in it and should let go of it? Or is there some other purpose or other value or other reason why this letting go of something that we call teachings? There's a second simile in the same sutta, which is more dramatic. And this is a simile of the snake, which is what gives the title to the sutta. The sutta is actually called the Discourse on the Simile of the Snake. And here it says that if you take a poisonous snake and hold it the wrong way, if you hold it by the tail, then it can turn around and bite you and kill you. In the same way, if you hold teachings in the wrong way, they can turn around and harm you as well. If you hold a poisonous snake the right way, if you hold it by the neck, then it can't turn its head around to bite, and then you can be safe. So in the same way, there's a way of holding teachings that makes the teachings safe for you, that the teachings won't undermine you, won't bite you, won't cause problems for you. Hold the teachings by the neck. And so that's a little bit more dramatic. The first one says, you know, just like a raft, take it or leave it. If you want to get across, you know, leave it behind. But here it says that the teachings you take on, how you hold them is very important, and you can be harmed by it. I think the implication being even good teachings can be harmful if you hold them the wrong way. If you're really attached to the truth might be good, but the attachment is not good for you. So two similes that I think are understandable. The reason the Buddha gave these similes was because of a monk with a pernicious view. There was one of his monks who was going around saying that what the Buddha calls obstructions are not really obstructions. And we're not sure what he was referring to, but in context, you'll see we probably have a good idea. And so the other monk said, no, don't say that. In many ways, the Buddha said these things are obstructions and we shouldn't be involved. And he said, no, they are not obstructions, the monk said. His name is Arita. And so then the monks went to the Buddha and said, hey, this guy is saying this stuff. And so the Buddha says, have him come see me. And so the Buddha says, is it true that you're saying that what I call obstructions are not really obstructions? And the guy says, how I understand the Buddha's teaching is that what he calls obstructions are not really obstructions. So he's really quoting the Buddha, saying this is what the Buddha teaches. And the guy says, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And the Buddha, who can be stern in these ancient texts, said, I should quote him, otherwise I'll get. He called him misguided man. You're a misguided man. And then he says, I actually taught this. In many ways I've taught that these are really obstructions. And then the Buddha goes on to say, and this is where we have a sense maybe of what this conflict, this issue was about. The Buddha says, that one can engage in sensual pleasures without sensual desires, without perceptions or conceptions of sensual desire, without thoughts of sensual desire or sensual pleasure, that is impossible. So probably the translation here in English is, I've looked at the Pali, it's probably a little bit different, slightly different, and you get a little different sense if I translate it for you. It's not possible to indulge in or pursue sensual pleasure without having desire for sensual pleasure, without having concepts of sensual pleasure, and without having thoughts about sensual pleasure. So it's not saying that sensual pleasure is bad in and of itself, but sensual to pursuit of it requires desire, concepts, ideas, and all kinds, and then also thinking about it. You know, what are you going to do? How am I going to get it? And all that, right? So probably this monk, remember monks were celibate, was saying that the pursuit of sensual pleasures, maybe even sexual pleasures, are not really a problem. They don't really get in the way of a monastic life. And so the Buddha was saying, no. I've said many times that for a monastic, this gets in the way. These are obstructions. And then he says this, and this is what he says, you know. So this is interesting, the idea that the pursuit or the indulgence in sensual pleasure requires here it's three kinds of mental activities. And the idea that it requires mental activity is very important. It requires desire, conceptions, ideas, and it requires thinking about it, like planning and things like that, focusing on it. The word is vitakka. And these are mental activities, and what's wrong with mental activities for someone who's interested in meditation? I think probably all of you know, because you meditated this morning, I suspect that a fair percentage of you had mental activities going on while you were meditating that you wish would quiet down a little bit quicker. You were thinking, maybe not sensual pleasures, but you were thinking about all kinds of things. And you said, you know, you tried to let go and come back and be focused, or probably be mindful of it so you wouldn't get caught in it. But you were involved in mental activities, probably. And some of you perhaps found that your mental activities quieted down the course of that meditation session. And so the strength of it quieted down and got a little bit calmer, and maybe not completely calm, but it got calmer. So that movement of being involved in mental activities that keeps us agitated to letting the mental activities fall away or relax so we're calm and relaxed is a primary movement in meditation in Buddhism. And so, as some of you probably know, especially if you remember yourself as a teenager, the concerns with sensual pleasure can be very active in the mind. And so, you know, it's kind of like, you know, maybe then you had a lot of energy, so you didn't notice how exhausting it was. But some of you are getting older, so maybe now, you know, give me a break. What the Buddha is pointing to is not, he's not criticizing the monk on moralistic grounds that sensual pleasures are bad. He's taking him to task because there was mental activities involved that keeps the mind busy, keeps the mind engaged, and keeps the mind involved in the world of concepts and ideas. And for someone who's a serious practitioner, there has to be an ability to let that become peaceful. But here the text gets more interesting. So he says this about these mental activities, concepts, intentions, and thinking. And then the Buddha switches, well, then he's to these two similes. That's, you know, the snake. So the way that we relate to thoughts, to desires, to perceptions and concepts, to ideas, can be a snake that bites you, or can be something that doesn't bite you, depending on how you hold on it. So he's probably saying this to the monk Arita. If you hold those kinds of teachings that you're teaching, you're going to hold them the wrong way, and the whole Dharma that I'm teaching is going to come back and bite you. And then he talks about the raft. This monk was so attached to his view that three different times other monks went to him and said, no, the Buddha didn't teach that, and he held on tight. He was holding on to his particular raft, even though it was not the Buddha's raft. So the Buddha says this. So here the focus is not the moralistic idea about sensual pleasure, but rather how we hold on to ideas, concepts, and teachings. Are you with me enough? So, and this is something we see over and over again in the teachings of the Buddha, that in addition to this question of what teachings might be true, what teachings might not be true, much more interesting for the Buddha is how people hold on to their teachings that they have. And so how does that affect our perception of a religious involvement, how we involve with religion, if the focus is not on the religious truths of the religion, but rather on how we hold them? And we can hold them in ways that they come back and bite us, perhaps. Or we can hold them in ways where we carry the raft with us after it's done its work. So he gives these two similes. And then the Buddha goes into a discussion about views. And views here, the word is ditti. And views here can be understood to be teachings, religious teachings especially. Because the Buddha was in a world of seekers in ancient time, people who were deeply engaged in searching for some kind of ultimate answer, solution, liberation in life. And apparently there was a large group of such people in ancient India in his time, and he was one of these wanderers and Brahmins and different people engaged in this process. And they had different views, different religious teachings that they saw as being ultimate, as being the main thing. And so he had to contend. He was in this environment. So now he goes into in a further discussion about views. And what's interesting, he's left far behind this teachings about sensual pleasure. And we see this in other teachings as well, that that the focus on what we could call ethics, as important as it is in the teachings of the Buddha, he seems to be sometimes very quick to leave that behind as being kind of lesser importance. It's important, but he's clearly not as interested in those things as he is what's more important. And in many places, what's more important has to do with how we relate to views, our opinions about how things are, the stories we tell ourselves, the concepts by which we understand ourselves. That's much more important than our ethics, though ethics is important. It isn't like we're diminishing, don't bother with ethics. But then he kind of quickly wants to go where it's more important for him, and this is what he does here. So then the Buddha says there are six standpoints for views, six basic kind of approaches to having religious views, ideas, or philosophical views. But to call them religious and philosophical views might make you think, well, I don't have to listen now. You know, this is now we're getting to philosophy, and you know, I knew it was going to get too heady here. It feels intellectual, but these are, I think, the way that the Buddha understands these are more deeply embedded in the structure of human thinking than simply, you know, some philosophy you can read in a philosophy book. Underlying, sometimes subconscious assumptions about who we are can fit into these views that he's going to describe. So it relates to all of us. It's just a matter of kind of finding how that works. So here they are. Whatever is the physical aspects of a human being, the form aspect of a human being, people will one way or the other take that as me, myself, and I. This is mine, me, myself, and mine. This is mine, my body is mine. Seems innocent enough. But to take my body as mine belongs to the world of concepts. It's a mental activity that we're engaged in to apply this is mine. And we know that now from these fascinating studies of people who have had certain brain damage, and they'll look at their hand and they don't see it as their hand. It's not their hand. And it's kind of like, I can't quite understand how that could be, because it's my hand, right? It's like it's so obvious to me. How could it not? But it's a particular mental functioning, maybe brain functioning, that sees the hand as my hand. Is that activity of attributing it to be mine something we always need to be involved in, or can that be put to rest? And, you know, that's pretty basic, my hand, but what about, you know, it's all kinds of things. My hair, right? I talked about my hair last week. I think, it was Monday night. Where I said I could write an autobiography of me and my hair. You know, it's a fascinating history of Gil and his hair and all the meanings of it and how I saw myself and how other people saw me. And, you know, my hair was me, so it was mine. And so me, myself, and mine. So in many ways, people take their body as me, myself, and mine. And probably all of you have in some way or other done that, where your happiness or your suffering was directly tied to identification with some aspect of your body, and it was too much this, not enough that of your body in some way. So that's one view, standpoint for views that people have. The other standpoint, next one that the Buddha offered, was one of the primary standpoints, is we take the word is feelings, but the word is vedana. I think it's better to maybe call it our sensing. Whatever we sense, whatever our sensations are, we somehow identify with those as me, myself, or mine. And then he went on to say, whatever we take as our concepts, we take as me, myself, and mine. And so I think in the modern world we can say that we can see people who identify very strongly with concepts, stories. I am this way, you are that way, and they hold on to that. And then one takes one's mental formations. Here, this is a kind of just way, one's mental activities, one's thoughts, one's ideas, one's bigger stories, one's intentions, all the whole inner world of kind of mental activities, one identifies that as being me, myself, and mine. And then you kind of drive this home further in the context of ancient India and the kind of beliefs that people had there. The Buddha said, the fifth standpoint for these kinds of fundamental views, when regards what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, and mentally pondered, this is mine, this I am, this is myself, me, myself, and mine. And what this is pointing to is in the ancient world, these were people who were deep in meditation, deep spiritual life, who would see things in their meditation, see things. They would see or cognize or hear different things that they took as being ultimate. One of the things, if you get really quiet and still, people feel they can see a very kernel of a sense of I am-ness. And so they're like, sometimes consciousness is seen this way. Everything else is impermanent, but consciousness is permanent. And this is who I really am. And we see this consciousness, we see something. The last thing the Buddha, there's six views the Buddha gave, is identifies equates the self, your soul, with the world or the universe. And this was in ancient India, kind of an idea that people had, that Atman is Brahman, that somehow that the core kernel of self, a soul, it's permanent, everlasting, is somehow identified or at one with the universal principle, the universal quality of aspect of the universe called Brahma, Brahman, and that the goal of spiritual life was to realize the oneness of those things. And that also the Buddha saw as succumbing to this idea, this activity of seeing things as me, myself, and mine. So what's the alternative? Is there an other view that the Buddha has? So these are six views that clearly the Buddha is not happy with. And the but before I tell you that, in order to add some drama and keep you connected, those of you starting to tune out. So in this ancient world, there were people who said yes. A lot of time the ancient, yes. Whatever we can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, whatever we can clearly see and perceive, whether it's inside our mind or in the world or anywhere, does it not qualify as a real permanent self? This is my soul. But there is a soul, there is an Atman, that can't be seen. It's there. And the Buddha said, basically he said, well, if it's there but it can't be seen and known, it has no value for you. You know, what use is it? Because the world which we suffer and hold on to and cling to is the world that we can see and think about. So then people got concerned hearing what the Buddha had to say. Wait a minute. Well, then the Buddha says, if a person does not cling or looks upon all this stuff without seeing it as me, myself, and mine, then one will not be agitated about what doesn't exist. So it doesn't exist that these things are truly me, myself, and mine. But if it doesn't exist, some people got agitated by this teaching because it's so important to be someone. And so some monk at that time asked the Buddha, can there be agitation about what is non-existent? And the Buddha says, yes, you can get agitated about what doesn't exist externally and what doesn't exist internally. What doesn't exist externally? This is interesting here. Interesting. So this is how you get agitated when something doesn't exist externally. Someone does not think, let's see here. If a person has the following way of thinking, alas, I had it. Alas, I have it no longer. Alas, may I have it? Alas, I didn't get it. Then he sorrows, grieves, and laments, weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. This is how there is agitation about what is non-existent externally. So if something doesn't exist, you can either, you know, you can want it or hope for it, or you had it and then it goes away. So it no longer is there, and so you get agitated. So you can see that we have expectations, we have desires, we have many things that fit into this category. But I think what's also being focused on here, I believe, is that there can also be concepts of a self, of a soul, that's kind of seen here in his language externally. But if teachings come along and say that is not there, or you've lost it, and it's so important to have it, then the person gets agitated. And then the Buddha goes on and talks about internally. And this is also very, very famous and very important sentence here. And also helps begin understanding maybe more deeply what's going on in these teachings. Someone hears the Buddha teach the Dhamma, teach the teachings, the truth, for the elimination of all standpoints, obsessions, clingings, and underlying tendencies, for the calming of all mental activity, for the relinquishment of all attachments, for the end of craving, for dispassion, for cessation, for nibbana. This is a little summary of the whole purpose of what the Buddha was trying to teach. He was certainly teaching for nibbana, for nirvana, for enlightenment. But that process of coming to the kind of ultimate freedom the Buddha talked about, involved an elimination, a relinquishing of all points of view, all philosophical views, all ideas of who I am, me, myself, and mine. Is that okay to do that? I mean, you know, how does one do that in a way that's realistic and appropriate? How do we do it so we don't end up, you know, being homeless maybe or something? But this idea that it's that letting go of all these views, religious points of view, is a pretty radical teaching in a world where adhering to tenets of religion is very important. So someone hears about this, and hearing this, the person thinks as follows. Oh no, I'm paraphrasing, oh no, I shall be annihilated. I shall perish. I shall be no more. So he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. This is how there's agitation by what is non-existent internally. So when these mental activities that are involved with having ideas about me, myself, and mine, mental activities about our desires, our wishes, our concepts, when that mental activity quiets down, then there can come the idea, oh, I'm going to disappear. I won't be here. I'll be annihilated. But, you know, there was nothing to be annihilated to begin with. But we can, because of these concepts, we think there is. And this is how a person can get agitated by what doesn't exist internally. You with me enough? So then, Buddha says, you may acquire you may well acquire a permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. You might acquire that possession, that thing, something possession, that is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and might endure as long as eternity. It might happen. But do you see any such possession, any such thing? And the monks answer properly. They say, no. We can't find, we don't see anything like that. There may be, but we don't see it. And then the Buddha goes on and says, Buddha says, good monks, I too do not see anything that is permanent and everlasting. Monks, you may well cling to that doctrine of self that may not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who clings to it. But do you see any such doctrine of self? No. And the Buddha says, good bhikkhus, I too do not see any doctrine of self that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who clings to it. So this is interesting, that there's no doctrine of self, idea of soul, which doesn't cause suffering if you cling to it. That's quite a statement, right? And then he says a similar thing about views. You may well take as a support that a view that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, and grief in the one who takes it as a support. But do you see such a view? Nope. Good, monks. I too do not see any supportive views, any views that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who takes it as a support. So not just a matter of clinging, but taking it as a support for one's life. That's a kind of radical teaching, right? So remember, last week I was trying to point to the radical teaching. So this is pretty radical. So what's the alternative? Why would he teach this? So we're running out of time here. So one of the reasons this is being taught is because as long as we're involved in mental activity and clinging to mental activity, we cannot be at peace. We cannot experience the possibility of being free from clinging. To really be able to free ourselves from clinging in a deep and thorough way, there has to be a letting go, temporarily at least, of our involvement in concepts and ideas, past and future, self and other, and all these things. And this is what the Buddha was pointing to. You might say, well, then I can't take care of myself. The Buddha is just taking care of himself very well right now. He's going into great detail. He's analyzing the teachings of his times. He understands them. He's engaged with taking care of his monastic order. He is doing these things. But as his teaching goes along, he says that for someone who gets liberated, for someone whose mind is liberated, it's not possible, or it says the gods cannot trace that person's mind. One cannot be define or understand or categorize a person who doesn't base their life on concepts and ideas and teachings. So the idea of someone who's liberated, it doesn't fit in nicely into the usual way of understanding. And so the gods, who somehow have psychic ability, that they look into that person's mind, they can't find anything there. They can't find someone to measure or understand. We might, human beings, might look at someone externally and say, well, that's a man, a woman, a monk, a layperson. But if you go inside into the mind is free, and the mind is free from adherence to these concepts and ideas. And so there's something that's untraceable about that kind of person. So I'll end with another, I think, kind of dramatic moment in this text. Therefore, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, it will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. What is not yours? Your body is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Feelings are not yours. Abandon them. When you have abandoned them, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Concepts are not yours. Abandon them. When you have abandoned them, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Mental activities are not yours. Abandon them. When you have abandoned them, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Consciousness is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. So what is it like? The Buddha has done this, has abandoned all these things. But from a conventional point of view, our point of view, he still had a body, he had feelings, he had perceptions, concepts, he had mental activities, he had consciousness. So he's certainly not saying, you know, like just jettison and leave them in the dump and go around without them. But abandon them, I think, means to abandon any clinging whatsoever to them, any adherence to them, any dependence on them, to be able to have them operate without being dependent on any of them. And if you then, if the God in you turns around and looks at your mind once you've let go, abandoned all these things, and look into your mind, you also will not find anything there. Isn't that nice? And you can go to the potluck too. So, for those of you who couldn't follow this talk, I apologize. I hope that the beginning of it, about the simile of the raft, is something you'll remember. I think it's a wonderful simile and teaching. Leave the raft behind once it's done its job. So, thank you.